This program is sponsored by the members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents for a discussion with David Roll, author of George Marshall, Defender of the Republic. I'm your host, Rob Havers, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. This program and hundreds more covering a full range of military topics is available on demand at pritzkermilitary.org. Winston Churchill called him World War II's organizer of victory, and Harry Truman said he was the greatest military man that this country ever produced. Today, few lives are more worthy of renewed examination than George C. Marshall and his 50 years of loyal service to the defense of his nation and its values. Heralded as a genius, even as a young officer, Marshall's reputation grew immensely in World War I, where his service in the Meuse-Argonne was heralded as a logistical masterpiece. During the interwar period, he helped modernize combat training and restaff the U.S. Army's officer corps with the men who would lead in the next decades. However, as World War II loomed, it was in the role of Army Chief of Staff where Marshall's intellect and backbone were put to the test. When his blind commitment to duty would run up against the realities of Washington's politics. Long seen as a detached, remote figure, Marshall emerges in this book as a man both remarkable and deeply human. The book is set against the backdrop of two world wars, civil war in China, the Korean War, and the Cold War. Marshall's education in military, diplomatic, and political power, replete with their nuances and ambiguities, runs parallel with America's emergence as a global superpower. The result is a defining account of a true citizen soldier and one of our most consequential leaders. David Roll is the author of The Hopkins Touch, Harry Hopkins and the Forging of the Alliance to Defeat Hitler, and the co-author of Lewis Johnson and the Arming of America, a biography of Harry Truman's defense secretary. He is senior counsel at Steptoe and Johnson, LLP, non-resident fellow at the German Marshall Fund, and founder of the Lex Mundi Pro Bono Foundation. Please join me in welcoming David Roll to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. David, it is a great pleasure to have you here this evening to talk about this phenomenal book and, of course, this incredible, long-lived character, George C. Marshall. And there have been several excellent books about Marshall in recent times. I was minded to think about the old adage about waiting for a bus in London. You wait several hours and two come along at the same time. And with a great book by Ben Steele on the Marshall Plan and the Dawn of the Cold War, right, and another book by Dan Kurtz-Phelan on Marshall's mission to China, we have been spoilt for choice in recent times with books on Marshall. So in light of these other works, what prompted you to begin writing? And you began writing this actually before these other two books. Why write one more biography of Marshall, and why now?
Yeah, I had no idea those books were in the works. But I started, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when Rob was at the Marshall Foundation. I walked into his office one time to introduce myself and speak with him, and I was just beginning. Why do this book? So the Harry Hopkins book, which was the second book I wrote, was really that's what inspired me to do Marshall. Harry Hopkins was a closest aide to President Roosevelt, lived in the White House for 3.5 years. And Marshall used Hopkins, when Marshall was Secretary of Chief of Staff during World War II, he used Hopkins as a window into what the Robert Sherwood called Roosevelt's heavily forested interior. Marshall, at the beginning of his relationship with Roosevelt, was on uncertain footing. He believed that Roosevelt chose him as the best of a bad bargain. He was jumped over a lot of other people that had longer services than he did. So he was wary, and so he used Hopkins, and they became friends. Two different, more different people you couldn't possibly make up. But when they went to visit with Churchill and in England before we even got in the war, they became fast friends. Marshall appreciated Hopkins's humor, and he really learned about Roosevelt, how Roosevelt thought through Hopkins. So that was one. And then the first book I wrote was about actually the founder of my law firm, Lewis Johnson, Stepstone Johnson, who was during the Second World War, before the Second World started, he was Assistant Secretary of War for under Roosevelt. And he claimed credit for helping Marshall become Chief of Staff. He claimed credit for a lot of things. But and then, so he bookended that end of Marshall's career. But at the other end of Marshall's career, Lewis Johnson was Secretary of Defense under Truman when the Korean War broke out under his watch. And Truman wanted to get rid of Johnson for a lot of reasons. And so Marshall replaced Johnson as Secretary of Defense in 1950, September 1950, a month after the Korean War broke out. So because of those two experiences, I decided to really dive into Marshall. Now, there were some books that concerned me that were coming out when I was writing that I felt tarnished to some extent Marshall's legacy. So I wanted to kind of dig into that and see whether I felt they were right. Did I disagree with them? Yes, I did, some of them. So anyway, that's how I got into it. I had no idea that that we would be in a political situation today where Marshall would stand out as a man of character and integrity, and a lot of people are comparing him in today's atmosphere. But 5 years ago, I had no idea that this was going to happen.
I remember that meeting, David, back in 2014, right. And I remember talking to people at the time who were talking about, and they'd been voicing this question for many years prior to that, which is, where is our contemporary iteration of a Marshall-like right. figure? There's a great quotation about your book from the wonderful Cold War historian John Lewis Gaddis, who noted that David Rohl's George Marshall could not come at a more crucial time. There's a growing conviction among Americans that their country no longer produces strategists and statesmen of Marshall's stature. Thanks to new sources on the general's life and the military establishment through which he rose, this thorough, balanced, and wise book goes far in assessing that claim. It crossed my mind while I was at the Marshall Foundation and in reading subsequently, that is there a sense that Marshall is being rediscovered in the contemporary world?
Yeah, I think there's been, of course, people have been talking about a Marshall plan here and a Marshall plan there. I mean, it started during the first Iraq war. Why don't we have a Marshall plan for Iraq? Why don't we have a Marshall, and then Marshall plan in the triangle in Latin America? So people, that's how they know, but they don't really know about, who was Marshall and what does a Marshall plan really work? Now, when I'm asked about the Marshall plan today, I typically say that the reason the Marshall Plan worked in 1947 to 48, and most people believe it was a spectacular success, it worked because they were dealing with governments with a history of governance, hundreds of years of governance, not necessarily democratic, but they were dealing with nations that were used to governance and the rule of law. And you don't, in the areas where people are talking about the Marshall Plan today, you don't have that. And I doubt it would ever work. You can't help but admire the man when you get into his life, his wives, the friends he had, the character that the man had. And that's what I spent a lot of time on. I mean, if there are two themes in the book, they are interior, Marshall's interior, and Marshall's character, and themes that I was able to develop because of the letters that were donated in recent years to the Marshall Library, and also to a box of correspondence that I was fortunate to discover through a Marshall relative, actually a step relative, in a Northwest Massachusetts farmhouse that were lent to me for several months. So it helped me discover his life and his character, his inner life and his character.
In my introduction, David, I said that Marshall traditionally is seen as somewhat of a remote figure, a detached figure, certainly a cool figure. And you've touched on this point briefly. You've done a lot to sort of get underneath that in this book. Could you tell us a little bit more how you did that? And you mentioned that a bit too. Right. But what picture, what Marshall emerges from this sort of holistic look at the man himself?
He had two wives, not at the same time, two wives. His first wife we met on the campus of the Virginia Military Institute, where he was. Mm-hmm. He was first captain of the cadet corps, and he met this woman, Lily Carter Coles, who was a stunning woman, the sort of the belle of the campus. And he married her and had a 25-year marriage. And it was the love of you know, a very romantic love kind of marriage. Very few letters. Mm-hmm. I think they were all lost or probably destroyed. But then at Fort Benning, he was at Fort Benning during the late 20s, early 30s, and he was standing in front of a fireplace at a friend's elegant house in nearby Columbus, Georgia, deep south, and a handsome woman entered the room. He was in his mid-40s because his first wife had died, and in walked a woman named Catherine Boyce Tupper, and they struck up a conversation. She was a former Shakespearean actress, played on the English stage, a remarkable woman, a striking presence. And he learned through that dinner, and I was able to actually find people, one person in particular who was at that dinner, was only 8 years old. Wow. And I really researched Columbus, Georgia, and what it was like at that time. Catherine was coming off the death of her husband, who was actually a lawyer who was murdered in Baltimore, 1927. She was in mourning when she met Marshall. But anyway, they struck up a conversation and eventually got married. And that was the most important person in his life. And the letters there, you know, did survive. And I was able to really develop Marshall's relationship with her three children. And in particular, the one that he was really enamored with, he fell in love with her youngest son. It was at the time he was 15 years old. But her youngest son became a tank officer in the war in Italy, beginning in 1943. And Marshall actually got this stepson of his into the 1st Armored Division. And so it's kind of a backstory to the book, because his stepson was killed while leading his tank platoon on the road to Rome in May of 1944. It was one of the great tragedies. But again, it was part of, you know, Marshall's interior and his relationship with his wife as he went through that. And that was just a few days before D-Day, when his son was killed. It was May 29th, 1944. Just a few days later, you have D-Day. And all that was going through Marshall's head when that was happening. Anyway, it provided a window into right. his life. He also had some very, very close friends, very few, but very, very close friends for the rest of his life. So his character, you know, how do you deal? It was discipline until it was ground into him, he would say. Just a little story about in January and February of 1942, when the war was going to hell, just at the beginning, right after Pearl Harbor, Marshall was, you know, just overwhelmed with work at the Pentagon, not at the Pentagon then, but a little later. But he would come home from the office on winter nights, and he would walk with Catherine in the twilight winter nights, and he would talk to himself. Catherine wrote about it. He would say such things as, I can't allow myself to get angry. He had a big problem with his temper. I cannot allow myself to appear tired. He learned that from General Pershing. Mm-hmm. Or I cannot afford the luxury of sentiment. And what he was thinking about was how he would have to tell General MacArthur, who's at that time his troops were on the Bataan Peninsula surrounded by the Japanese. He would have to tell him that his troops were doomed. That he and Eisenhower could not get a rescue mission from MacArthur. Or he would have to tell his best friends, generals, many generals who they could not, they were too old to command troops. So he was under those kinds of pressures. But his character, he disciplined himself, he willed himself, he talked to himself. He worked on that. So that was a large part of the book was developing his character. And of course, the Overlord decision, you'll right. come to that, I'm sure.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Marshall's career is astonishing in so many ways and marked by a longevity. Graduates from VMI in 1900, commissioned officer in 1901, retires from the Army in December of 45, a day of retirement, special envoy for the President, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Nobel Prize winner. But Marshall is marked out early on, even before World War I, that begins to develop his reputation as a young officer who's going places. Where do you think that came from the very beginning? It's apparent later in life, but did you discover anything that pointed to an origin?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the book where he really made his mark in the old regular army where, you know, everybody knew each other, the officers and the higher officers knew each other. It was in the Philippines, and there were maneuvers. And Marshall at the time was a second lieutenant, or maybe, no, I guess he's the first lieutenant in 1914. But in any event, there were maneuvers in the Philippines, and they were a mock battle. And for sort of just fortuitous circumstances, Marshall ended up, even though he was at low rank, running one of the white, you know, they were two forces, and he was running the white force because the general that was supposed to be doing it was an alcoholic, and they had to remove him early on because he screwed everything up at the beginning. And then there was another guy that was chief of staff at the time, and then he got sick. So it was Marshall that ended up commanding the white force. And he was recognized as a genius at strategy and at simple commands, simple orders. He was commanding a 5,000 troops in this maneuver. And at that time, Hap Arnold, who later became head of the Air Force, mm-hmm. was a young officer, and he wrote his wife, and he said, I've just been with a man who's going to be chief of staff of the U.S. Army someday. That word just rocketed throughout the Army. And so he was tagged at that point, 1914, as someone to watch. And of course, then he distinguished himself in the First World War and gained the recognition of General Pershing. And by the end of the war, First World War, he was Pershing's closest aide.
I think what is astonishing is that, and you're right, in World War I, he builds on this reputation.
Right.
He earns the sort of sobriquet of the wizard for his logistical brilliance, Samuel, Musagon. But he always wants a combat command. And yet, paradoxically, his success as a staff officer and this seeming genius for logistical operations means that his success works against him and he never gets that combat command. When you look ahead and see the chief of staff in World War II presiding over this vast citizen soldier army, it's hard to think that there could have been a better individual to be in that role. Cometh the hour, cometh the man. One of the things that strikes me also about Marshall is that within that long time period serving in the army is how long it takes him to pin that first star on. He enters World War I as a captain. He becomes a brevet colonel at the end of it, but returns to his formal rank at the end of the conflict. And not until the fall of 36, 35 years in the army, does General Marshall pull on that first star. It's astonishing. What kind of a man is that patient? And what does that say about him?
I know.
He's ambitious, undoubtedly.
You know, the reason why he didn't get that first star was because he'd never commanded troops in World War I. He also had Pershing as his mentor. Pershing was, you know, recommending him, and it wasn't until, as you say, 36. And by that time, MacArthur was already chief of staff. So what did he go through? He had he had the death of his first wife in 1927. He went through a very difficult time then, and he had to get out of Washington, and he got this assignment to go to Fort Benning. And that's, of course, where he met his second wife. But Fort Benning was, as he wrote, magical. It gave him an opportunity to run the academic program and for him to really develop small unit tactics and how to teach them. And it turned out there were like 200 of the people that he taught and during that period became generals, 200 of them. And they became generals in the next war, in World War II. So people like Omar Bradley. But he had an opportunity to assess and evaluate and teach and train these dozens of these men who became generals in the next war. And it was an intellectual experience for him. It also gave him time to get over his first wife. He loved to ride and hunt and fish in the sprawling Fort Benning area. Made a lot of friends in Columbus, Georgia. Mm-hmm. How he went. Then they sent him to Chicago, and MacArthur sent him to Chicago, and he really thought that he didn't like it at first. He thought it was another backwater. It was going to push him, his career back. But he made the most of it. He ended up liking it. Did a lot of maneuvers in the West, in the Midwest. But you're right, patience. It was incredible because it did take him long. He thought about leaving. He wrote letters to VMI. Thought about becoming superintendent at VMI. Fortunately, didn't do it. He was offered by Dwight Morrow, who was working for J.P. Morgan, whose daughter was Ann Lindbergh. Dwight Morrow offered him $30,000 in the 20s to work at J.P. Morgan. He turned it down. And then, but still, that was 10 years or so before he got his first star. But, and even just getting the chief of staff job was by no means a lock. You know, he had those two incidents. He was up for chief of staff in 1938. And he was in the back of the room. He was at the cabinet room in the White House, November 1938. Cabinet room is filled with the big brass Navy, Army generals, the cabinet, And Marshall was sitting in an alcove in the back. And Roosevelt was wheeled in his wheelchair at the head of the table. And this was when right after Kristallnacht. And Roosevelt was trying to figure out how to deter Hitler from his aggression. And so he came up with this plan that he announced at this cabinet meeting. He said, we need to produce 10,000 more planes. That's what we need to do. He made the pitch for that because he thought that would be, he didn't say it, but what he wanted to do was sell the war planes to France, French, and the English, and that they could then use the war planes to deter Hitler, because Hitler had a huge, the Luftwaffe was huge. So he went around the room to everybody, and everybody was sycophants. They were all saying, yes, that sounds like a great idea. Similar to what we see today sometimes. And Roosevelt saw, he knew Marshall's name. He said, well, what do you think about this, George? Using George's first, Marshall's first name, which Marshall didn't like because he didn't feel that he had that kind of relationship with Roosevelt at that time. But he was up for chief of staff. And Marshall said, well, I don't agree to, I don't agree at all with that, Mr. President. And it ended the meeting. Roosevelt was shocked to hear this, nobody basically disagreeing with his plan. He was the only one in the room who did. And Marshall's friends said as they were leaving, well, that's it for you. But actually, Roosevelt appreciated it. And then Roosevelt sent Hopkins to meet with Marshall. And it was Christmas 1938-39 when they had this moment. This actually was a couple hour meeting, Hopkins and Marshall. And that's when Marshall told Hopkins what they should be doing in terms of getting ready for the coming war. And then Hopkins went to Roosevelt and said, this guy really knows his stuff. You should consider him for chief of staff. So another meeting in 1939, that's what Roosevelt did. Actually, he said to, he brought Marshall into the White House. It was a Sunday, April 1939. And he said, by this time he called him Marshall. He said, I'm thinking of making you chief of staff. What do you think about that? And Marshall allegedly said, well, not that much, but let me tell you something. If you really want me to be chief of staff, there are going to be unpleasant moments. I'm going to have to tell you the truth as I see it. And I want you to understand that. He said it nicely, but it was direct. And, Roosevelt looked up and smiled at him, and he said, no, I'm serious. I want this to work. I will do the best I can. But there, I'm going to tell it the way I see it. And next thing he knew, he became chief of staff.
The dynamic between Marshall and the president is a key one for World War II and for victory in that conflict. I've read that Marshall was very aware that FDR, like so many politicians at that level, have a captivating demeanor to them, and they're very appealing and they're very persuasive. And Marshall was always cautious not to engage with the president socially.
Didn't want to.
And always maintain that professional distance. And you mentioned that another classic example, Marshall was asking the president to call him General or Marshall, but never George. He wanted that clear boundary of professionalism. Right. And that speaks to a man who knows his strengths, but also mitigates his weaknesses in some sense. Mm-hmm. He knows that he's as susceptible as anyone, potentially. And that's apparent throughout their relationship and Marshall's career. Anything else about the sort of relationship between the two that strike you particularly?
There was a moment, when and Marshall was always skeptical at the beginning about, here was this, this remarkable politician, you know, who held, who kept things, you know, hidden. Mm-hmm. His motives were often hidden. And he was suspicious of the political part of Roosevelt. He thought, you know, he's never direct. He couldn't tell exactly what, you know, where he was going. He would tell stories, and then, so a moment came though in February of 1942, when MacArthur and the president of the Philippines, MacArthur and the president of the Philippines were holed up on Corregidor, surrounded, embattled. And the president of the Philippines, Quezon, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing the name correctly, but Quezon sent a letter or a cable to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt and Marshall sat reading this cable, and also a letter from MacArthur. Basically, the president of the Philippines was saying that the U.S. needs to grant the Philippines independence right now, so that then the president of the Philippines, with now being independent, could declare neutrality, mm-hmm. and then convince the Japanese that they're a neutral nation, so that the Japanese and the U.S. troops would be able to withdraw, and nobody would get massacred. In other words, grant us independence. And MacArthur appeared to support that position also. I mean, literally, they were surrounded. They were going to get. They were either going to have to die or surrender. And at that point, Roosevelt read that and he said, "We can't do this. We're not going to do this. If the Philippine troops want to leave, fine, but the U.S. is going to remain there till the last man. You know, we're not going to, because the Japanese are never going to leave." And we're not going to give up that way.
Right.
And Marshall said at that point, and he wrote about it, he said, "I decided at that point that Roosevelt was a great man." And of course, they got MacArthur out. They got Quezon out. Quezon actually paid MacArthur $500,000. Nobody knows much about that, but because MacArthur had helped Quezon raise his army, and part of the deal was he was going to get paid. It was a lot of money, and that's what made MacArthur rich, because he wired it back to Chase Manhattan Bank, and that's what he lived on for the rest of his life. So, but that was a moment when I think that Marshall really felt, this guy, you know, I'm with him. You know, of course, actually then Marshall helped MacArthur get the Congressional Medal of Honor, mm-hmm. when he left Bataan.
One of the big questions about the sort of the FDR-Marshall relationship is, why is it that Marshall is not appointed to be the plum role in World War II, yeah. the overlord commander, the role that goes to General Eisenhower? Marshall absolutely wanted it, ambitious man, famously doesn't advocate
let me tell that story.
His position. Okay. Please, yeah. Do, yes.
So it was December 5th, 1943. Yeah. Roosevelt and Marshall were in Cairo. Roosevelt called Marshall in. And the invasion of the invasion of Normandy was set for early June of 1944. Anyway, this is December 1943, and Roosevelt calls Marshall to his villa, and he beats around the bush for a little bit, and then he says, "Do you want to command Operation Overlord?" That's the invasion. Basically, puts it right to him. And Marshall refuses to answer. Basically, demurs. He doesn't answer. He said, "Do you want that command?" He said, "No, Mr. President, you need to make the decision according to the best interest of the country, and you should not consider my feelings." And with that, then Roosevelt said, Well, I could not sleep at ease with you out of Washington, which meant that Eisenhower got the command, which was a springboard to the presidency. So did Marshall really want that command? You know, he regretted never getting command of troops in World War I, but at this point, did he really want the command? And some of his closest associates, namely Henry Stimson, felt he did. But he didn't, you know, there's no evidence. Or did he really think it was in the best interest of the country for him to remain in Washington, where he could continue to influence the course of the entire global war? No one knows for sure, but again, this was a mark of his character, his selflessness. You know, if he really wanted it, why didn't he say it? Or if he said, you know, why didn't he say it? And, you know, this was the code, sort of the moral code that he lived by. And Henry Stimson, Secretary of War, older than Marshall, he was a Presbyterian, and he had this proverb that he used to describe Marshall's character and his selflessness. He that ruleth his own spirit is better than he that taketh a city. A great way to characterize his. Now, why did Roosevelt make that decision after that conversation? Because if Marshall said, "I do want a command over it," I think that Roosevelt would have given it to him. Why didn't he, though? Well, there was lobbying going on back in Washington in the fall of 1943. The Joint Chiefs back in Washington, King and Hap Arnold, they did not want Marshall to take that command because he was doing a great job of basically guiding them, holding the whole thing together, because there's a lot of inter-service rivalry. So and King was leaking this to the press, that if Marshall took the command of Overlord, it would be a demotion. Mm-hmm. It would be, because he was commanding a particular operation rather than basically being the dominant voice in Allied strategy. And Churchill played a role in this also. Churchill and Roosevelt had a conversation earlier when Roosevelt talked about Marshall being the commander of Overlord, and said, and Roosevelt said, of course he would command all of Europe. And Churchill said, no way. We have the Mediterranean. We're not giving that up to an American. And so it really would be a demotion for Marshall to basically just do Overlord, just. But for that reason. And then the other reason is that Roosevelt said, why monkey? Why monkey with a winning team? So for those reasons, Marshall did not get the command. And we'll never know.
No, that's right. Churchill ascribes to Marshall the title of the architect of victory in World War II. Is that accurate? Was he?
Architect of victory. You know, he used the word organizer. You mentioned that earlier. And he was, you know, he was more an organizer. Was he the architect? A lot of people were the architects of victory. I mean, you know, you had so many people, but he held the Joint Chiefs together. Some say Leahy was also, and there's a book written about that, what was more influential than Marshall, but I think he was the most influential person in terms of grand strategy. Churchill also called him, aside from the organizer victor, the noblest Roman.
That's right, yes.
He said that at Potsdam when they were having dinner together. Architect of victory, probably, if you had to, there were so many.
There's a great moment in your epilogue when you talk about, you refer to the famous occasion when Marshall goes to Harvard, delivers the address that births the plan that becomes the Marshall Plan, and you quote from the citation to the honorary degree right. that he receives, that reads, to George Catlett Marshall, an American to whom freedom owes an enduring debt of gratitude, right. A soldier and a statesman whose ability and character brook only one comparison in the history of this nation. And although the comparison goes unsaid and unspoken, it is obviously to George Washington. Looking back now, is that comparison as strong and as accurate as it was then? And is it an accurate comparison?
I think it's right on. As a soldier and statesman, he brooks only one comparison. I think that's right. Another soldier and statesman was Ulysses Grant. But I don't think he brooks comparison in terms of his, his presidency was not very successful. I think that's right. I want to tell one story though about that speech. When I was giving a talk at another place in Washington, I called up, I know David Ignatius, the columnist, but his father, David Ignatius's father, Paul Ignatius, who is 99 years old. And Paul Ignatius was at Lady Gulf in the Navy. He was Secretary of Navy under Kennedy. He was chairman of the Washington Post. He's a very prominent guy. He's now 99. Booming voice, great. And so I called him and I said, would you come to my talk and say a few words? I have a feeling that you may have something to say about Marshall. And he said, well, I'm already signed up for the talk. But he said, you know, Dave, I was in Harvard Yard when Marshall gave the talk, June of 1947, the Marshall Plan speech, which was Harvard Yard. I said, come on, are you kidding me? What were you doing there? And he said, I just graduated from the Harvard Business School and I was happened to be in the audience. And I heard the great man give this talk. I had no idea what it meant. And the president of Harvard didn't really realize the significance of the speech when it was given, but the British certainly did. They were on top of it. And anyway, I just love the fact that there are still people around that.
I did not know that. Yes. Very interesting. The speech itself, which births what becomes the Marshall Plan, astonishingly brief, 11 minutes, I think it is, to change the world, 12. Essentially. 12 minutes, yes. 11 or 12, whatever.
It was supposed to be 10 minutes, though.
But it's incredible that a soldier like Marshall can... He delivers, really, he throws down the gauntlet, in a sense, to the United States to think about preserving the fruits of victory, hard won on the battlefield in two world wars, possibly frittered away in the interwar years, and he saw what happened. But he was adamant post-World War II that the peace that had been won would endure. And so it would not be a case of winning the war and losing the peace. How far ahead was he thinking, do you think, when he delivered that address?
Well, he had he basically came back from, in the spring of 1947, came back from a meeting with Stalin, convinced that Stalin wanted nothing to do with restoring Europe. What he wanted to have happen was that there'd just be, it would remain a charnel house, as Churchill said, and then the communists could take over these various governments, and that Stalin had no interest in reviving any of those countries. So, you know, he came back, and by that time they had the benefit of George Kennan's long telegram. Marshall had read it when he was in China, 1946. And the first thing he did was call on Kennan. So he had this idea, we've got to do something. But his genius was bringing in the people to help him figure that out. But he have a vision? Yes, he had a vision. He said, we need to do something. We can't let this economy evaporate. He brought in this guy, Will Clayton. Nobody knows much about Will Clayton. Will Clayton was a dollar a year guy working in the State Department, but he was, before that, he was what would be today a billion-dollar cotton trader. This guy was a trade, international trade expert. He brought in Cannon, he brought in Will Clayton. And basically, you know, they helped him, you know, put meat on the bones of his vision, which was, what are we gonna do and how do we do it? And he would basically help put these people together. He had Acheson, he had Clayton, he had Lovett, he had Bolin, and you know, they call them the wise men. And you know, we've never seen the likes of that with those people. But it became, you know, partially a trade deal, partially an altruistic deal, a humanitarian deal. But it all came together. It was Marshall's ability to bring these people and to, you know, hold them together, listen to their arguments, and then make decisions. But in terms of the Marshall Plan speech itself, he decided on his own when it would be given and what it would say. He had three different people, you know, write pieces of it, but he took the pieces, put it together, and it was understated. He did that deliberately. The gamble was the Marshall Plan was going to be offered to the Soviets and to all of their satellite states. And Cannon and Marshall was worried. He said, what if they accept it? What if Stalin accepts this whole Marshall Plan idea? And Cannon said, don't worry, play it straight. They'll never accept it because Stalin will never want to have his economy scrutinized by other nations in Europe. And he was right. He had a vague vision, but these individuals helped him fill in. And his genius was selling the program to Congress and the American people. And he deliberately became friends with Arthur Vandenberg, who at the time was, by this time the Republicans had taken over the Congress. So you had a situation where you had a Democratic President Truman, Democratic administration, and a complete Republican Congress in both houses. That happened in 1946. And Arthur Vandenberg from Michigan was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. He was key. He was the guy, and he was a former isolationist. So Marshall and Vandenberg became friends. They were at a conference in South America together. And Vandenberg had to be courted. He had to be courted, and he had to have his own stamp on the Marshall Plan. And Marshall brought him in. And the two of them are the ones that got it through Congress. So vision, execution, implementation, not so much. Once they launched it, got it through Congress, Marshall went on to other things, mainly NATO, the Berlin airlift, that was all going on at the same time. You know, you had the Berlin airlift, you had the formation of NATO and the Marshall Plan all at the same time in 47 and 48. And it made the world that we live in today.
Yeah, it really did. Marshall's influence lives on today in that astonishing fashion. There's a great collection of letters, as I'm sure you know, in the Marshall Foundation, correspondence between Churchill and Marshall and Churchill to the Marshall Foundation. There's one letter in particular, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, but written by Churchill after Marshall's death, I think, or close to Marshall's death, and when he endorses the idea of creating the Marshall Foundation and a repository for Marshall's paper. And Churchill talks specifically about how succeeding generations must not be allowed to forget Marshall's contribution to the modern world. Churchill, self-promoter, par excellence, couldn't be more different to Marshall. But it always seemed to me that that comment from Churchill was grounded in an idea that there was a chance that actually Marshall could be forgotten. Do you think that's the case, David, today? You've done a great job of ensuring that is not happening, but
I don't know.
In the big scheme of things, George C. Marshall, where does he stand in that panoply of great American leaders and heroes, and why is he not better known today?
Well, number one is he didn't command troops in combat. He wasn't Patton, he wasn't MacArthur. Omar Bradley, less so. I think that That name, that Marshall Plan thing, will probably never be forgotten. You know, do we need another biopic or a documentary or something like that? Yeah, at some point I think we do. The problem was his modesty also. Mm-hmm. He also, you know, he wouldn't write his memoirs. He would not. He was offered, Saturday Evening Post offered him $1 million to do his memoirs. And, he, you know, he basically said, you know, if I do that, I'm going to alienate some people and have to talk about personalities and so forth. You know, I wrote an op-ed piece that was published in Newsweek, but comparing Mattis, General Mattis, and Marshall in terms of speaking out, mm-hmm. because Mattis recently, when he resigned, said, "I have a duty of silence." Now, Mattis is like Marshall in the sense that he was both a commanding general and a Secretary of Defense, so he had to have the law passed, just as Marshall had to have the law passed to allow them to become Secretaries of Defense. So he's unique in that sense, in that relationship to Marshall. But he said, "I have a duty to remain silent." But Mattis hasn't quite remained silent because of his resignation letter and a few comments he's made since. But Marshall had an eternal code of silence. Right. He just would not write his memoirs. He gave interviews, but again, he would not really get into the criticisms. I mean, I'm sure he has some stories he could tell about Churchill, because they went head to head.
They did indeed.
On strategy, on grand strategy, all the time. So, I say one thing about another point, moment that Churchill had with Marshall. It was May of 1943, and they were in at a conference. I think it was in Washington. And they had Overlord was not going to happen until 44, and Stalin was beside himself that we had delayed the invasion so long, and they were, you know, millions of Soviets were dying on the battlefield. And once again, Churchill said to Roosevelt, "I want to take Marshall back to the Middle East with me, and we'll talk to some of the commanders." And what Churchill wanted to do was to convince Marshall to put off the Overlord thing and go up through the Balkans. So on the plane, over to Algiers, across the Atlantic, it was Churchill and Marshall were flying together. And Churchill asked Marshall to write the letter to Stalin, the cable to Stalin. They had to explain to Stalin why, once again, it was going to be delayed. And it had to be diplomatically and tactfully done. And so Churchill asked Marshall to write it. And Marshall wrote it. And then Churchill later said, "I decided then that Marshall was a statesman. He had a commanding view of the whole situation, a penetrating and commanding view." That's what he wrote it, the way Churchill would write it. So that's when Churchill became convinced that Marshall was a great man.
Right.
That's
a great point to end on. There are many more things we can say about George C. Marshall, but we will go to question and answer. David Roll, thank you very much.
Thank you. So my question was, intriguingly, you said at the beginning that part of the reason for writing a book about Marshall was that you were aware of some other people that were writing things that might end up tarnishing his reputation. Because I love to hear all sides of the story, I'm wondering if you could share what you thought those people would say or what they ended up actually saying about him.
Well, the one that really got me was there's a book that came out shortly before mine did. It was called The Second Most Important Man in the World, The Life of Admiral Leahy. And that was written by a fellow named O'Brien at Cambridge, I think, in England. And his thesis was that Admiral Leahy, who came into the Joint Chief organization in the summer of 42, he was, before that, he was ambassador to Vichy, Vichy France. And Leahy was beyond, by that time he was too old to really serve in the Navy in any combat situation. But anyway, he was a friend of Roosevelt's. And so Marshall helped Leahy. Marshall was the one who recommended, we need to have another Navy man in the Joint Chiefs. So Marshall actually convinced Roosevelt to bring Leahy back to Washington. But in any event, the book, the thesis of the book is that Leahy was far more influential with Roosevelt in terms of grand strategy during World War II than Marshall. And there's an actual chart, chart in the book, various incidents and decisions that were made in which the author claimed that Leahy was the influential man making those decisions. And so I disagreed with it and got kind of steamed up about it at one point. So I didn't agree with it. And I thought that was it was not fair to the significance that I understood that Marshall had and the lack of significance that Leahy had. And certainly wasn't the second most important man in the world by any measure, I didn't think. And then there was another book, the Unger-Hirshhorn book, that seemed to basically want to diminish Marshall's reputation and sort of suggested that he was by no means responsible for, by no means that big of a figure in American history. There were that, and there's a couple other things that came along. And there hadn't been anything, I thought, there was a nice book written 20 years ago by Ed Cray, I thought, I thought that was, but no one was reading it. It didn't seem. And the magisterial book about Marshall was written by Forrest Pogue at the Marshall Foundation. But again, that was dated. A lot of things had happened since then. A lot of new information and revisionist thinking. So I felt that did need to be updated. So there's that out there. Again, and there people were questioning whether the Marshall Plan really needed to be done in order to revive Italy. So there were economists making arguments that I felt needed to be addressed.
Thank you for being here. Could you describe the relationship between MacArthur and Marshall?
Oh yeah, I like that. In a word, I think that Marshall regarded MacArthur as a management problem. I mean, let's face it, he was a complete pain. But rightfully so, setting aside the debacle, after Pearl Harbor in the Philippines, he was constantly complaining about lack of resources, lack of personnel when he was fighting in New Guinea. But he was being shortchanged. But Marshall couldn't help it. He wasn't doing it deliberately. He was doing everything he could to get stuff out to MacArthur. So his relationship, Marshall tolerated him. I mean, also, I think I've said to other people, the most surprising thing I learned when I was writing this book was how magnanimous and deferential Marshall was toward MacArthur. Because MacArthur, I think, I think he suspected Marshall of, undermining him to some extent, not doing enough. And there was some hostility. But Marshall rose above that, I believe. After he didn't get the Overlord Command, they were in Cairo at the time. And instead of going back to Washington after he had that conversation with Roosevelt, he flew 15,000 miles the other way, east across the Middle East, and down across the Indian Ocean, across Japanese-held territory, to meet MacArthur on a remote island off the coast of New Guinea. And he did that to show him how serious he was about making sure he got things that he needed. He basically consulted with, but what do you need? I'm out here to help you. And no one else had done that. So it was a magnanimous gesture. Manchester said that there was hostility, that Marshall was hostile in his book. And I took issue with that. Marshall, that statement about you don't have a command, you have a court, he said, that he was quoted in the Manchester book as saying to MacArthur that he was like a king, that he had a court, all of his aid. And Pogue said that no such thing was ever said by Marshall, and he could document that. So, point is, he regarded Eisenhower as a management problem. He regarded General Mark Clark as a management problem. That was his thing, and he kept his feelings about them hidden, I think, if he had those feelings. But MacArthur was a hero to him. He knew what he'd done in World War I. So many Silver Stars. He was brave. He was a brilliant commander. Brilliant in New Guinea and, of course, brilliant at Incheon. The surprising thing was how deferential. And another reason was Marshall, when he had to end up firing MacArthur, he was the last man before Truman to say yes. He worried about firing MacArthur because MacArthur was the army. I mean, he and Marshall was an institutionalist, and he felt it would undermine, the fabric of the army to because he was so important to the army for 50 years. So that's how I felt about the relationship.
If Marshall had accepted Supreme Allied Commander, would Eisenhower, and if not Eisenhower, who do you think would have been made Chief of Staff, and how do you think that would have played out?
That's probably, yeah. It would be logical to send Eisenhower back to run the Chief of Staff, and King didn't want that. Because they didn't know Eisenhower like they knew Marshall, but they didn't think that would be a good thing for Marshall to end up coming back to Washington. He wasn't strong enough. They didn't believe. Whether they were right or not, I don't know. But that was one. That's another reason why they were doing the lobbying in Washington. I mean, Eisenhower had great skills at dealing with people, so he could well have. Done a good job in that regard. And Marshall commanding Overlord, I can't imagine he would not be one of the great commanders in that situation. But, you never know.
Ladies and gentlemen, the book is George Marshall, Defender of the Republic. David Roll, thank you so much tonight for a fantastic discussion. A pleasure, as always. Thank you to David Roll for a great discussion. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Be a part of our live studio audience, explore military history, and learn more about our series by visiting pritzkermilitary.org.
Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.